All right, today I'm reading from Irving Goffman's Frame Analysis, an essay on the organization of experience. Chapter 1, Introduction. There is a venerable tradition in philosophy that argues that what the reader assumes to be real is but a shadow, and that by attending to what the writer says about perception, thought, the brain, language, culture, a new methodology, or novel social forces, the veil can be lifted. That sort of line, of course, gives as much a role to the writer and his writings as is possible to imagine, and for that reason is pathetic. What can better push a book than the claim that it will change what the reader thinks is going on? A current example of this tradition can be found in some of the doctrines of social psychology and the W.I. Thomas dictum, quote, if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences, end quote. The statement is true as it reads, but false as it is taken. Defining situations as real certainly has consequences, but these may contribute very marginally to the events in progress. In some cases, only a slight embarrassment flits across the scene in mild concern for those who tried to define the situation wrongly. All the world is not a state. Certainly the theater isn't entirely. Whether you organize a theater or an aircraft factory, you need to find places for cars to park and coats to be checked, and these had better be real places, which, incidentally, had better carry real insurance against theft. Presumably, a, quote, definition of the situation is almost always to be found, but those who are in the situation ordinarily do not create this definition, even though their society often can be said to do so. Ordinarily, all they do is to assess correctly what the situation ought to be for them, and then act accordingly. True, we personally negotiate aspects of all the arrangements under which we live, but often once these are negotiated, we continue on mechanically, as though the matter had always been settled. So too, there are occasions when we must wait until things are almost over before discovering what has been occurring, and occasions of our own activity when we can considerably put off deciding what to claim we are doing. But surely these are not the only principles of organization. Social life is dubious enough and ludicrous enough without having to wish it into further unreality. Within the terms, then, of the bad name that the analysis of social reality has, this book presents another analysis of social reality. I try to follow the tradition established by William James in his famous chapter, The Perception of Reality, first published as an article in Mind in 1869. Instead of asking what reality is, he gave matters a subversive phenomenological twist, italicizing the following question: under what circumstances do we think things are real? The important thing about reality, he implied, is our sense of its realness in contrast to our feeling that some things lack this quality. One can then ask under what conditions such a feeling is generated. And this question speaks to a small, manageable problem having to do with the camera, and not what it is the camera takes pictures of. In this answer, James stressed the factors of selective attention, intimate involvement, and non-contradiction by what is otherwise known. More importantly, he made a stab at differentiating the several different worlds our attention and interest can make real for us, the possible sub-universe, the orders of existence, to use Aaron Gershwitz's phrase, in each of which an object of a given kind can have its proper being. The world of the senses, the world of scientific objects, the world of abstract philosophical truths, the worlds of myth and supernatural beliefs, the madman's world, etc. Each of these sub-worlds, according to James, has its own special and separate style of existence. And, quote, each world, whilst it is attended to, is real after its own fashion. Only the reality lapses with the attention, close quote. Then, after taking this radical stand, James copped out. He allowed that the world of the senses has a special status, being the one we judge to be the realest reality, the one that retains our liveliest belief, the one before which the other worlds must give way. James, in all this, agreed with Husserl's teacher, Brentano, and applied, as phenomenology came to do, the need to distinguish between the content of a current perception and the reality status we give to what is thus enclosed or bracketed within perception. James's crucial device, of course, was a rather scandalous play on the word world, or reality. What he meant was not the world, but a particular person's current world, and, in fact, as will be argued, not even that. There was no good reason to use such billowy words. James opened a door. It let in wind as well as light. In 1945, Alfred Schutz took up James's theme again in a paper called On Multiple Realities. His argument followed James's surprisingly closely, but more attention was given to the possibility of uncovering the conditions that must be fulfilled if we are to generate one realm of reality, one finite province of meaning, as opposed to another. Schutz added the notion, interesting but not entirely convincing, that we experience a special kind of shock when suddenly thrust from one world, say, that of dream, to another, such as that of theater. And he has a long quote here. There are as many innumerable kinds of different shock experiences as there are different finite provinces of meaning upon which I may bestow the accent of reality. Some instances are the shock of falling asleep as the leap into the world of dream, the inner transformation we endure if the curtain in the theater rises as the transition into the world of stage play, the radical change in our attitude if, before a painting, we permit our visual field to be limited by what is within the frame as the passage into the pictorial world, our quandary, relaxing into laughter, if, in listening to a joke, we are for a short time ready to accept the fictitious world of the jest as a reality in relation to which the world of our daily life takes on the character of foolishness. The child's turning towards his toy as the transition into the play world, and so on. But also the religious experiences in all their varieties. For instance, Kierkegaard's experience of the instant as the leap into the religious sphere are examples of such a shock, as well as the decision of the scientist to replace all passionate participation in the affairs of this world by a disinterested contemplative attitude. End quote. And although, like James, he assumed that one realm, the working world, had a preferential status, he was apparently more reserved than James about its objective character. Quote, we speak of provinces of meaning and not of sub-universes because it is the meaning of our experience and not the ontological structure of the objects which constitute reality. End quote. And he attributes its priority to ourselves, not to the world. Quote, for we will find that the world of everyday life, the common sense world, has a paramount position among the various provinces of reality, since only when within it does the communication with our fellow men become possible. But the common sense world is from the outset a socio-cultural world, and the many questions connected with the intersubjectivity of the symbolic relations originate within it. They are determined by it and find their solution within it. End quote. And Schutz refers to the fact that our bodies always participate in the everyday world, whatever our interest at the time. This participation implying a capacity to affect and be affected by the everyday world. So instead of saying of a sub-universe that it is generated in accordance with certain structural principles, one says that it has a certain cognitive style. Schutz's paper, and Schutz in general, was brought to the attention of ethnographic sociologists by Harold Garfinkel, who further extended the argument about multiple realities by going on, at least in his early comment, to look for rules which, when followed, allow us to generate a world of a given kind. Presumably, a machine designed according to the proper specifications could grind out the reality of our choice. The conceptual attraction here is obvious. A game such as chess generates a habitable universe for those who can follow it. A plane of being, a cast of characters, with a seemingly unlimited number of different situations and acts through which to realize their natures and destinies. Yet much of this is reducible to a small set of interdependent rules and practice. If the meaningfulness of everyday activity is similarly dependent on a closed, finite set of rules, then explication of them would give one a powerful means of analyzing social life. For example, one could then see, following Garfinkel, that the significance of certain deviant acts is that they undermine the intelligibility of everything else we had thought was going on around us, including all next acts, thus generating diffuse disorder. To uncover the informing, constitutive rules of everyday behavior would be to perform the sociologist's alchemy, the transmutation of any patch of ordinary social activity into an illuminating publication. It might be added that although James and Schutz are convincing in their arguing that something like the world of dreams is differently organized from the world of everyday experience, they are quite unconvincing in providing any kind of account as to how many different worlds there are, and whether everyday, wake a life, can actually be seen as but one rule-producing plane of being, if so seen at all. Nor has there been much success in describing constitutive rules of everyday activity. He has this long footnote. Schutz's various pronouncements seem to have hypnotized some students into treating them as definitive rather than suggestive. His version of the cognitive style of everyday life he states as follows. 1. A specific tension of consciousness, namely wide awakeness, originating in full attention to life. 2. A specific epoch, namely suspension of doubt, a prevalent form of spontaneity, namely working, a meaningful spontaneity based upon a project and characterized by the intention of bringing about the projected state of affairs by bodily movements gearing into the outer world. 4. A specific form of experiencing one's self, the working self as the total self. 5. A specific form of sociality, i.e. the common intersubjective world of communication and social action. And 6. A specific time perspective, that is, the standard time originating in an interaction between durée, the flow of life, and cosmic time, as the universal temporal structure of the intersubjective world. These are at least some of the features of the cognitive style belonging to this particular province of meaning, as long as our experiences of this world, the validity as well as the invalidated one, partake of this style, we may consider this province of meaning as real. We may bestow upon it the accent of reality. Yeah, so all of that was a quote from Schutz in a footnote to this statement. Okay. One is faced with the embarrassing methodological fact that the announcement of constitutive rules seems an open-ended game that any number can play forever. Players usually come up with 5 or 10 rules, as I will, but there are no grounds for thinking that 1,000 additional assumptions might not be listed by others. Moreover, these students neglect to make clear what they are often concerned with is not an individual's sense of what is real, but rather what it is he can get caught up in, engrossed in, carried away by. And this cannot be something he can claim is really going on, and yet claim is not real. I'm sorry, this can be something he can claim is really going on, and yet claim is not real. One is left, then, with the structural similarity between everyday life, neglecting for a moment the possibility that no satisfactory catalog might be possible of what to include therein, and the various worlds of make-believe, but no way of knowing how this relationship should modify our view of everyday life. Interest in the James Schutz line of thought has become active recently among persons whose initial stimulus came from sources not much connected historically with the phenomenological tradition. The work of those who created what has come to be called the theater of the absurd, most fully exhibited in analytical dramas of Luigi Pirandello, the very useful paper by Gregory Bateson, A Theory of Play and Fantasy, in which he directly raised the question of unseriousness and seriousness, allowing us to see what a startling thing experience is, such that a bit of serious activity can be used as a model for putting together unserious versions of the same activity, and that, on occasion, we may not know whether it is play or the real thing that is occurring. This long parenthetical. Bateson introduced his own version of the notion of bracketing, a usable one, and also the argument that individuals can intentionally produce framing confusion in those with whom they are dealing. It is in Bateson's paper that the term frame was proposed in roughly the sense in which I want to employ it. End of parenthetical, but he has a footnote. The work of John Austin, who, following Wittgenstein, suggested again that what we mean by really happening is complicated, and that although an individual may dream unrealities, it is still proper to say of him that on occasion he is really dreaming. The efforts of those who study, or at least publish on, fraud, deceit, misidentification, and other optical effects, and the work of those who study strategic interaction, including the way in which concealing and revealing bear upon definitions of the situation. The useful paper by Barney Glaser and Anselm Strauss, Awareness Concept, Context, and Social Interaction. Finally, the modern effort in linguistically oriented disciplines to employ the notion of a code as a device which informs and patterns all events that fall within the boundaries of its application. I have borrowed extensively from all these sources, claiming really only to the bringing of them together. My perspective is situational, meaning here a concern for what one individual can be alive to at a particular moment, this often involving a few other particular individuals and not necessarily restricting the mutually monitored area of a face-to-face gathering. I assume that when individuals attend to any current situation, they face the question, what is it that's going on here? Whether asked explicitly, as in times of confusion and doubt, or tacit, during occasions of usual certitude, the question is put and the answer to it is presumably by the way the individuals then proceed to get on with the affairs at hand. Starting, then, with that question, this volume attempts to limb out a framework that could be appealed to for the answer. Let me say at once that the question, what is it that's going on here, is considerably suspect. Any event can be described in terms of a focus that includes a wide swath or a narrow one, and, as a related but not identical matter, in terms of a focus that is close up or distant. And no one has a theory as to what particular span and level will come to be the other the ones employed. To begin with, I must be allowed to proceed by picking my span and level arbitrarily, without special justification. A similar issue is found in connection with perspective. When participant roles in an activity are differentiated, a common circumstance, the view that one person has of what is going on is likely to be different, quite different than that of another. There is a sense in which what is play for the golfer is work for the caddy. Different interests will, in Schutz's phrasing, generate different motivational relevance. Moreover, the variability is complicated here by the fact that those who bring different perspectives to the same event are likely to employ different spans and levels of focus. Of course, in many cases, some of those who are committed to differing points of view and focus may still be willing to acknowledge that theirs is not the official or real one. Caddies work at golf as do instructors, but both appreciate that their job is special, since it has to do with servicing persons engaged in play. In any case, again, I will initially assume the right to pick my point of view, my motivational relevance, only limiting this choice of perspective to one that participants would easily recognize to be valid. Further, it is obvious that in most situations, many different things are happening simultaneously, things that are likely to have begun at different moments and may terminate dissynchronously. To ask the question, what is it that's going on here, biases matters in the direction of unitary exposition simplicity. This bias, too, I must be temporarily allowed. So, too, to speak of the current situation, just to speak of something going on here, is to allow reader and writer to continue along easily in their impression that they clearly know and agree on what they are thinking about. The amount of time covered by current, just as the amount of space covered by here, obviously can vary greatly from one occasion to the next and from one participant to another. And the fact that participants seem to have no trouble in quickly coming to the same apparent understanding in the matter does not deny the intellectual importance of our trying to find out this apparent consensus consists of and how it is established. To speak of something happening before the eyes of observers, it is to be on firmer ground than usual in the social sciences. But the ground is still shaky, and the crucial question of how a seeming agreement was reached concerning the identity of the something and the inclusiveness of before the eyes still remains. Finally, it is plain that retrospective characterization of the same event or social occasion may differ very widely, that an individual's role in an undertaking can provide him with a distinctive evaluative assessment of what sort of an incident the type the particular undertaking was. In that sense, it has been argued, for example, that opposing rooters at a football game do not experience the same game. And what makes a party a good one for a participant who has made much of it is just what makes it a bad one for a participant who has thereby made little of it. All of which suggests that one should even be uneasy about the easy way in which it is assumed that participants in an activity can be terminologically identified and referred to without issue. For surely, a couple kissing can also be a man greeting his wife, or John being careful with Mary's makeup. I only want to claim that although these questions are very important, they are not the only ones, and that their treatment is not necessarily required before one can proceed. So here, too, I will let sleeping sentences lie. My aim is to try to isolate some of the basic frameworks of understanding available in our society for making sense out of events, and to analyze the special vulnerabilities to which these frames of reference are subject. I start with the fact that from an individual's particular point of view, while the one thing may momentarily appear to be what is really going on, in fact what is actually happening is plainly a joke, or a dream, or an accident, or a mistake, or a misunderstanding, or a deception, or a theatrical performance, and so forth. And attention will be directed to what it is about our sense of what is going on that makes it so vulnerable to the need for these various rereadings. Elementary terms required by the subject matter to be dealt with are provided first. My treatment of these initial terms is abstract. The reader must initially bestow the benefit of the doubt in order for both of us to get to the matters that I feel are less dubious. The term strip will be used to refer to any arbitrary slice or cut from the stream of ongoing activity, including here sequences of happening, real or fictive, as seen from the perspective of those subjectively involved in sustaining an interest. A strip is not meant to reflect a natural division made by the subjects of inquiry, or an analytical division made by students who inquire. It will be used only to refer to any raw batch of occurrences, of whatever status in reality, that one wants to draw attention to as a starting point for analysis. And of course, much will be used of Bateson's use of the term frame. I assume that definitions of a situation are built up in accordance with principles of organization which govern events, at least social ones, and our subjective involvement in them. Frame is the word I use to refer to such of these basic elements as I am able to identify. That is my definition of frame. My phrase, frame analysis, is a slogan to refer to the examination in these terms of the organization of experience. In dealing with conventional topics, it is usually practical to develop concepts and themes in some sort of logical sequence. Nothing comes earlier, depends on something coming later, and hopefully, terms developed at any one point are actually used in what comes thereafter. Often the complaint of the writer is that the linear presentation constrains what was actually a circular affair, ideally requiring simultaneous introduction of terms, and the complaint of the reader is that the concepts elaborately defined are not much used beyond the point at which the fuss is made about their meaning. In the analysis of frames, linear presentation is no great embarrassment, nor is the defining of terms not used thereafter. The problem, in fact, is that once a term is introduced, it begins to have too much bearing, not merely applying to what comes later, but reapplying in each chapter to what it has already been applied to. Thus, each succeeding section of the study becomes more entangled, until a step can hardly be made because of what must be carried along with it. The process closely follows the horrors of repetition song, as if, in the case of frame analysis, what old MacDonald had on his farm were partridge and juniper trees. I'm gonna skip a little. Caveat, disclaimer, note about the materials, anecdotes, he draws on clippings. Okay, it's interesting. So he has a break halfway through what's called introduction, and then he says, that is the introduction. Writing one allows a writer to try to set the terms of what he will write about. Accounts, excuses, apologies designed to reframe what follows after them, designed to draw a line between deficiencies in what the author writes and deficiencies in himself, leaving him, he hopes, a little better defended than he might otherwise be. This sort of ritual work can certainly disconnect a hurried pedestrian from a minor inconvenience he might cause a passing stranger, just as certainly such efforts are optimistic in their purposes to recast the way in which a long book is to be taken, and more optimistic still in the case of a second preface to an already prefaced edition, this being an attempt to recast a recasting. Okay, and another break. But what about comments on prefaces? Where does such a topic taken up at such a point leave the writer and the reader, or a speaker and an audience? Does that sort of talk strike at the inclination of the reader to discount or criticize preface as an activity? And if it turns out to be the preface was written in bad faith, tailored from the beginning to exemplify this use that will have come to be made of it, will the preface then be retrospectively reframed by the reader into something that really isn't a preface at all, but an inappropriately inserted illustration of one? Or if an admission of bad faith is made unconvincingly, leaving open the possibility that the disclosure was an afterthought, what then? And another break? And does the last comment excuse me in any degree from having been puerile, and obvious in commenting on prefaces, as when, in a book analyzing jokes, the writer is excused the badness of the cited joke, but not the badness of the analysis of them, is a parenthetical, a novelist who nowadays injects direct address in the body of the work. Dear reader, if you've gone this far, you'll know I hate that character. Easily fails to change the footing we allow him. But what if he writes that he would like to succeed in such an instance, but knows we will not let him? Another break. And what about discussions about being puerile and obvious? A word incorrectly spelled can, I think, be successfully used by the misspeller as an illustration of incorrect spelling and analyzed as such. But can a writer posture in his writing and then effectively claim that all along he was only providing an illustration of bad taste and lack of sophistication? Would it be necessary for him to show, and if so, how would he, that his claims were not merely a device hit upon but after the fact to make the best out of what he had not been able to prevent from being a bad thing? And another break. And if in the first pages, after acknowledging colleagues who had helped, I had said, Richard C. Jeffrey, on the other hand, did not help, and if I had gone on here in these later pages to suggest that the aim had been to make a little joke and incidentally bring awareness to a tacit constraint on acknowledgement writing. And he keeps going for many pages. And if the preface and the comments on the preface and the comments on the comments on the preface are put into question, what about the asterisks which divide up and divide off the various sections in which this is managed? And if the orthography had still been intact, with this last question itself had undermined these framing devices, including the ones which bracket this sentence with the prior one. And then he analyzes that statement.
Okay.
And if I wanted to comment on the next to last sentence, the one containing apparent parenthesized quoted sentence and questionably real asterisk, could I quote that sentence effectively? That is, employ the apparently required punctuation marks and yet allow the reader an easy comprehension of what was being said about what? Would the limits of doing things in print have been reached? Then he has another break. It says, that is what frame analysis is about.